Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Sheila Jeffries. She's the author of 10 books on the history and politics of sexuality. She's been actively involved in feminist and lesbian feminist politics, particularly around the issue of sexual violence, since 1973. Today we'll be talking about queer theory. So first off, thank you for your work and thank you for being on the program.
That's fine. My pleasure.
So what is, for those who have not read all the academic stuff, what is queer theory? Is it just like we should like, I mean, what is queer theory?
Well, before so-called queer politics and queer theory developed from about 1990 onwards, there was feminism and there was lesbian feminism. Lesbian feminism developed in the early 1970s from women who left gay liberation. Gay liberation was a political movement which had a structural basis. It was anti-capitalist. It was one of those movements that was revolutionary in the 60s and 70s. It was, you know, allied with black liberation and other forms of resistance movements. Feminist lesbians left gay liberation because it was very male-dominated, even though it was politically a much more developed movement than anything we've seen in recent times. So lesbian feminists left, created a movement of lesbian feminism, which used the word lesbian, which was never normally used because, of course, the word gay doesn't include the word lesbian. Lesbians were always really subordinate within gay liberation. In 1990, we'd had a period in which feminism and lesbian feminism had been pretty much under attack and had been very much weakened in the 1980s, because that was a period generally when there was backlash against liberation movements in general, against socialism, against feminism, particularly from the mid-1980s onwards. And the lesbian feminists that I talked to reckon that the movement was pretty much in decline from about 1985. So when queer politics developed, there was not a strong feminism to attack it. And I think lesbian feminists, because they'd not been involved in mixed gay movements, were not in there in a position to attack what developed. So queer politics developed as a backlash against a response to hostility towards gay men that was developing around AIDS in the 1980s. So it was a politics, first of all, a sort of street fighting politics, of men in particular, because if AIDS affected men, it didn't really affect lesbians, saying, we're here, we're queer, get used to it, and doing street actions and so on in order to sort of be a strong front against the oppression they were feeling at that time. It was never, it never had a structural basis. It was not anti-capitalist. It was, from the very beginning, individualistic, libertarian, and queer politics included the groups that were involved, included in what was supposed to be queer, included, say, the masochists, or some included also paedophiles, and so on. So it was about a sort of a grouping of those who saw themselves as sexual revolutionaries, and in fact, in that way, very much the opposite of anything that was connected with feminism, because lesbian feminism and feminism had critiqued all of these practices for the way in which they subordinated women. The word queer itself is very much of a problem because historically lesbians have never been visible and have never been involved in the naming of homosexual liberation movements. There was homosexual, there was gay, none of it meant lesbian. Lesbians had to stand up for themselves to get the word even mentioned, to get it even recognized that women existed. Women in Britain who were lesbians never used the term queer. Certainly lesbian feminists would never have imagined the term queer because they needed a specific term which talked about them as women. So queer is a term that comes from probably mainly American gay men's politics. So to begin with, it was simply a crushing blow against the extent to which lesbian feminists in America and other places had actually fought to get a recognition that lesbians mattered, that women mattered. You know, by the late 1980s, often conferences and so on would call themselves lesbian and gay. Often the word lesbian would come first because we had fought for recognition that we existed. The term queer smothered all of that. It wiped out the possibility of the recognition of lesbians and a recognition of the fact that lesbians and gay men were not just some sort of simple overall grouping run by gay men, that actually there was a contradiction of interests. The queer theory is slightly different because, of course, that developed in the academy and is not exactly sort of coterminous with queer politics, but it provides the theoretical backing for that development as queer politics, queer theory developed in the 1990s. So I think the important thing about queer politics and queer theory is that they have no structural analysis whatsoever. There's no recognition of oppression, that any groups in society are oppressed or that capitalism is a problem, that it's not really, there's no socialism involved in queer politics. It's libertarian and individualist from the beginning, very much about the defense of gay men's sexual interests and gay men's sexual practices, which, as I argued in Unpacking Queer Politics, are very problematic for feminists. For instance, the individualist expression of various sexual practices was seen as transgressive. The word transgressive was used a lot in relation to queer politics and queer theory. I understand transgression as something which 17th century aristocrats in Britain did, and it usually meant being very unkind to women in prostitution and so on. So transgression is the way in which sort of privileged men use others, usually a lot less powerful than themselves, in order to be naughty. It's never intended to create social change, and of course transgression cannot create social change because it's not exciting unless there are actually social constraints and limits that you see yourself as crossing over. So transgression was never a revolutionary tactic, but it was a very exciting tactic for quite a lot of those, it seems, who were involved in queer politics. The other problem that developed, obviously, as queer theory developed, was the fact that it distinguishes the category woman itself. Because queer politics in the academy was a version of and a development of postmodern post-structuralist theory, which, as well as talking about how you can't have really political movements because they're aimed at something and there mustn't be any kind of end point, everything has to be fluctuating, everything has to be constantly in a state of flux, and so on. Also said that categories needed to be in a state of flux. You couldn't actually be a woman or black and so on because these were categories that needed to be exploded. And so the queer theorists exploded the category woman.
Wait. Okay, my brain is exploding because I don't understand what I hear. I'm sorry to interrupt. I hear what you're saying, but I still don't understand what queer theory is. I mean, which is the problem I've been having when I read all this queer theory stuff is like, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I don't understand. I'm sorry. I'm feeling stupid. I feel like I can't understand what you're saying. Can you slow down just a little bit? Like there's a quote here from a book called Queering Anarchism that says queer can be understood as what is at odds with the normal or legitimate.
Yes.
And that doesn't make any sense to me either.
What's at odds with the normal and legitimate is the stuff I was talking about, which is transgression. Any kind of ordinary rules that societies have created, some of which may be problematic and some of them not, need to be stepped over. As I said, that the nobility males in Britain did when they developed sadomasochism and so on in the 18th century. So, yes, it's seen as against, it's seen as countercultural because it's disobeying sexual rules. It's a sort of sexual liberation movement, queer politics and its justification in queer theory, I argue, for gay men. So it incorporates all of the sexual practices that gay men have developed. Historically, a lot of those practices actually come from the subordination of gay men. So they are not necessarily to be celebrated. For instance, one of the practices that becomes supposedly transgressive and revolutionary in terms of queer politics and queer theory is public sex. Back in the 1990s, there were a number of volumes dedicated to saying how transgressive was public sex, which is a practice that some gay men are involved in, of engaging in sexual practices in parks, under bridges, on towpaths and so on, because that supposedly, you know, it's going to frighten the horses, it's going to upset the bourgeoisie, and it's transgressive because it's in your face. And a lot of the writing about public sex in the 1990s from gay men was very self-congratulatory and triumphalist, and saying how public sex was actually the best and the most extraordinary thing. Of course, lesbians have never involved themselves in public sex, one of the differences being that lesbians have traditionally wanted relationships with others rather than simply to engage in short sexual acts, whether in public or anywhere else, which is, of course, partly the result of the different construction of both male and female sexuality. And gay men, of course, are not engaging in something which is specifically gay, but comes out of the construction of male sexuality around something that is less relational and treats sexuality rather differently. So public sex, as I argue in Unpacking Queer Politics, is actually problematic because of the construction of sexuality that it represents, which is a sexuality which is objectifying, potentially aggressive, and is very much the opposite of what feminists have always argued, which is that male sexuality has to dramatically change in order to remove from women's necks unwanted sexual practice, sexual violence, and so on. Because queer theory and queer politics was about defending the sexual practices of gay men in particular, pornography was very important to queer theory and queer politics, because pornography has been very, very important to a lot of gay men. And indeed, a lot of the writings in the 90s about pornography said that that was what taught gay men that they were worthwhile and that they didn't have to be oppressed, because they saw their sexual practices represented in pornography, and that made them proud. And indeed, gay male pornography became an important part of the expanding pornography industry in the 1990s. And as I argue in Unpacking Queer Politics, the problems associated with pornography for the women who are used in it for heterosexual men exist also for gay men, in as much as the bottoms, those who get penetrated, were often seriously drugged in order to do the practices. They didn't gain status from those practices, but very much the opposite of that as a general rule, and the practices portrayed in the pornography were often extraordinarily abusive and became more abusive in the way that practices within heterosexuality become more abusive in the pornography, through things like double penetration and triple penetration and fist fucking and those sorts of things. So pornography, public sex, some other practices that were celebrated and revered within queer politics as very much the epitome of what queer politics was supposed to be all about, were precisely the practices that feminist theory and politics had identified as the most problematic and those which most needed to be changed.
So I mean, thank you for saying all this, and I'm still very confused. I remember when I was about 20, I went to one of those huge rock music festivals, and I happened to be standing next to two people who were extremely drunk who started having sex on the field. And I just found this fairly disgusting. But so are you suggesting that, well, not you, but... So would the queer theorists be suggesting that this was a revolutionary act?
Yes, there are quite a few queer theorists do in fact suggest that it's a revolutionary act, yes.
And why is capitalism still standing then?
Capitalism is still standing because it isn't a revolutionary act. I do suggest that public sex, to some extent, developed from the subordination of gay men. It was very difficult for gay men historically to have relationships with each other, and therefore brief casual encounters in public toilets, for instance, were all that was allowed as a sexual expression for them and the only thing that they were able to do. That doesn't, of course, explain why it is that lesbians have never been involved in that kind of sex, because lesbians also were subordinated and unable to have relationships with each other publicly and so on. But that's the general explanation as to where the interest in public sex comes from. But because queer theory was celebratory and about saying that everything queer and to do with the whole history of homosexuality was actually positive rather than potentially a negative and the result of oppression, it became necessary to say the public sex in itself needed to be celebrated.
Well, two things. One is, I remember when I lived in Idaho, when I was in my late 20s, there was a drug, there was an arrest at a public rest area where they arrested one of the school board members, and this was a big scandal. And I remember talking to a gay male friend of mine, or a gay friend of mine, about this, and he said, "Wow, that's just really sad that this person, his sexuality was such that he had to go to there in order to have a sexual relationship, as opposed to being able to just simply have a sexual relationship." So it seems to me, I'm saying this in an attempt to validate what you're saying about how I don't think that's something actually to be celebrated. I think that's actually something that's really sad and is a measure of the oppression. That was one thing. And then, the other is, this all reminds me of Diogenes, the cynic, a couple thousand years ago, who one of the things he would do, he believed very strongly in basically all social rules are meant to be violated, and all social rules are constraining. And so one of the things that he would do is he would walk around the public market masturbating. And when people would get upset that he was masturbating in public, he would say, "I wish it were as easy to sate my hunger by rubbing my belly." And his point was that his superficial point was that, this is a natural act, so we should all just do this in public. But the real point was that he was violating social boundaries to be violating social boundaries. And the important thing was that for there to be a violation or a transgression, both of those require a victim. And if he's masturbating by himself, nobody is getting violated. But if he's masturbating in public, he is forcing other people to participate in his sexuality. And it's the same for public sexuality or public sex, that I didn't ask to be part of the sex of those people next to me. They were making me an unwilling participant in their sexuality, which is, by definition, not liberatory. Instead, it is a violation of my right to not be assaulted by them being sexual in front of me. And the people I'm talking about in the rock and roll case, they were heterosexual. I mean, the actual physical parts involved are irrelevant here.
Yes, I think that the problem with public sex is because it's only one of the practices that were celebrated and romanticized in queer theory, is that it's a part of a defense of male sexual practices which come from the sexual expression of the dominant group. The dominant group sexually, which is males, eroticize their power position, and part of the eroticizing of that power position is the excitement of violation, the idea of the violation of others. So unfortunately, for male sexuality, violation, which usually has as its victims women in the form of sex with sexual abuse of children, rape, and so on. That's an important element of the sex of the male ruling class. So unfortunately, it's not revolutionary to engage in that kind of violation stroke, a transgression, but that is one of the things that in queer theory was seen as something to be celebrated. It's actually fairly fundamental to the construction of male sexuality.
Well, that makes a good segue into pedophilia, and I want to do a quote here by Christine Grogan, and then after that ask you about the relationship between queer theory and pedophilia, and the relationship from the beginning, really. And the quote by Christine Grogan is, "As these feminists pointed out, incest itself, and more broadly the sexual exploitation of children by adults, is not the taboo, for it happens quite often. Talking about it is." And I'm just saying that in terms of, they like to pretend that they're transgressing if they talk about pedophilia, but that's not actually transgressing. If they talk about sex that involves violation or sex that involves power, but that's not actually going against cultural traditions at all. That's just patriarchy 101. And go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes, that's right. And I think it's interesting that the key text which became so important to queer theory's understanding of sexuality was by a theorist of gay sadomasochism in the United States called Gail Rubin, and it's called Thinking Sex, and you actually find it at the very beginning of several anthologies on theorizing sex in the 1990s. It was seen as so important within queer theory. And she argues there that indeed precisely those who are transgressive, the sadomasochists, the pedophiles, and so on, are the ones who are going to break down all the terrible constraints on sexual activity that need to be attacked. They are the future. They are the revolutionaries. So in fact, her theoretical position on the importance of these transgressive activities became very important to queer theory. I cannot say, though, that the paedophilia was defended by queer theorists apart from Gail Rubin. I haven't really seen much of that.
That's a conversation that you and I can have off radio at some point, because I devoted a couple chapters to the relation between pedophilia and queer theory in a book I have coming out in a year and a half, and I actually found quite a lot of support, which I found just dreadful.
You may well have. I didn't write about that, and I didn't discover that.
Let's go back to there's a line in the movie Philadelphia, I think it's called, the one about Tom Hanks is dying of AIDS, and
yep.
The guy who plays his lawyer, African American actor. I can't remember his name right now. Anyway, he has this line he says a bunch of times where he says, okay, explain it to me like I'm a six-year-old. You know, make it really simple. So let's go back to the beginning again. Explain, just in one or two sentences, you know, explain it to me like I'm a six-year-old. What is queer theory, and then what is wrong with it? I know you've said it, but I think, okay, here's the reason that I'm hemming and hawing and keeping asking you about this is that queer theory is huge, and it's taken over academia, and I'm desperately trying to understand why.
Yes. Well, I think the reason that it's taken over academia, if we start with that first, is that it was seen as transgressive and exciting at a time when sexuality became something that could be studied in universities, and it was anti-feminist. That is the crucial thing. There was a considerable reluctance in academia to put up with women's studies and feminist interventions in the academy. Queer theory provided an alternative, something which came from men's interests and defended men's interests and was extraordinarily critical, if not diametrically opposed to feminism from the beginning. So for that reason, queer theory was something that looked pseudo-exciting in the academy and cancelled out feminism. So that was very exciting and very important and gave it all its momentum in the 1990s. For instance, here at the University of Melbourne, I was brought in specifically to teach lesbian and gay studies because the university got sort of gold stars, and in fact I think I was probably the first person teaching a lesbian and gay studies course in the country at that time. It was called Politics of Sexual Reform Movements because students didn't want on their CV the word lesbians and gay, but it was actually a history of lesbian and gay movements. That ran very successfully for a couple of years. And then queer theory hit, so I started teaching it in 91. By 93, queer theory took over, and the course died because the only students in it who were fascinated were heterosexual. No lesbian or gay students would come to that course after 93, because politics, the politics of gay liberation, lesbian feminism, and so on, were completely overturned by queer theory. So I think that's a really good sort of example of what happened when queer theory hit. Suddenly my students became the lesbian and gay students, who once I would have had, suddenly became very hostile to the very idea of the course that I'd been brought in to teach.
So, you know what this is reminding me of is there's this thing in environmentalism called neo-environmentalism, and it's the idea that there is actually no such thing as wilderness, and there is actually no such thing as basically the real world. And instead,
yes, I know about that.
Instead, there is only our ideas about it.
And very postmodern.
Yeah, and that really reminds me of basically like what Allen Ginsberg said about pedophilia, that it's not the pedophilia that harms the children, but instead it's the stories we tell about the pedophilia that harm the children. And except he doesn't say it that nicely. He basically says if all those hysterical adults wouldn't freak out, the children would get used to our lovemaking in a few days. That's what he says. And this is, so it seems to me that really both the queer theory and the neo-environmentalism are expressions of backlashes against both liberatory movements and also consequences of the postmodern idea that that stories are more important than physical reality.
That is right, but also are more important than the reality of the stories, the actual factual stories that women tell of their own abuse and that children tell of their own abuse, because those no longer matter. Certainly back in the 1970s, before queer theory ever hit, lesbian feminists in Britain, and myself included, were fighting moves by paedophile organizations like the Paedophile Information Exchange to reduce the age of consent. There was also at that time an organization called Gay Activists Alliance, which wanted to reduce the age of consent to 4. Which shows that there was a considerable lack of understanding of the problem of child sexual abuse in some parts of the gay left. But mainly Paedophile Information Exchange was a heterosexual paedophile organization. It seems shocking now that these ideas were ever tolerated at the time, they were in the public world, and seen as respectable in a way that they wouldn't now. So when queer theory came along in the 90s, I guess, it in as much as it was picking up gay defenses of many practices, which originate in heterosexuality, because paedophilia is in origin and its massive form heterosexual, those practices could become something that was defended by a queer theory, which was about the promotion of male sexual practices in general. But I don't want to see it or identify it as in any way specifically homosexual.
Right. So let's go back to the Denzel Washington, that's the guy. Let's go back to the explain queer theory to me like I'm a 6-year-old.
Yep. Okay, so queer theory, as I understand it, developing in the early 1990s, even though there were some feminists who immediately got onto this and thought it was a good idea, which I did not understand, but it was basically about creating into a politics and a theory the many forms of male sexual practice and male sexuality. So I understand it as a defense of male sexuality, particularly a defense of gay male sexuality, because it came particularly from gay male activists. But it was a complete opposition to feminism, in as much as feminists had actually said male sexuality must be totally deconstructed and reconstructed in order to make women safe. But instead, queer theory constructed a defense of male dominant sexuality and homosexuality. So the practices that we've been talking about, public sex, sex with numerous others, sadomasochism, and so on, became the signature practices of this politics. So it was a politics, I think, that also you could see as being very much associated with the development of the sex industry and pornography, and a defense of a pornographized approach to sexuality, a male-dominant pornographized approach. But then it got spun off in ways that became really quite hard to understand, because, of course, it picked up postmodern, post-structuralist theory. And so we get the development of the work of theorists of queer theory, such as the lesbian Judith Butler. And in that work, and I think this is one of the reasons why this element of queer theory was in some way confused with feminism, Judith Butler talks about transgressing gender. Now, gender is a problematic term. Back in the 1970s, we talked about sex roles, feminists. We didn't talk about gender. Gender, by about 1979 and by the 1980s, is a term that is adopted by feminists to a large extent. Originally, of course, feminists adopted it to mean the socially constructed behavior that men and women were supposed to engage in that was actually oppressive, stereotype roles, what we used to call sex roles. By the 1980s, there's lots of, you know, grand feminist theory saying that gender is actually it's the system of oppression itself, all very problematic because gender in the end does mean simply sex stereotypes, and that's what most people understand it to mean. So what happened with Judith Butler was that she said you could, if you transgressed the sex stereotypes, then you were in fact doing something dramatic and remarkable. In fact, really, you could create revolution if men went down the street in high heels and skirts and women went down the streets in whatever, because actually women have been for quite a long time allowed to wear trousers, so it's quite difficult for women to do transgression and dress in the same way. The problem with that, of course, is that lesbian feminists and many feminists had never done gender anyway in that sense. They had rejected stereotypes. So, but we'd done so as a something positive and feminist, whereas the transgression of gender idea of Butler and others in the 1990s was that you actually deliberately adopted the sex stereotype behavior and clothing of what was seen, what was understood to be acceptable to the opposite sex, rather than that you rejected gender. So there was no rejection of gender. There was a huge adoption of it. I think because adopting gender was sexually exciting. Gender was an important part of sadomasochism, dressing up as a stereotyped aggressive male in black leather, for instance, could be exciting in the dominant role in sadomasochism and so on. So gender, because it's a mild form of sadomasochism in and of itself, the idea that the male should look powerful, be able to stand on his own 2 feet, be comfortable. A woman cannot stand on her own 2 feet and has to be on high heels and in pain. The sadomasochism is there in those roles in itself in a mild form. It has been adopted into sadomasochism more generally in a more overt form. So there was this huge defense of gender. I think it does come down to sexual practices very much in the end. And indeed, Judith Butler has written about how she considers herself to be a butch and cannot deal with femininity and so on and so on. So queer theory defended gender, whereas the feminists had always attacked gender and said it was the basis of women's oppression, this idea of stereotype roles, and it had to go. As that developed during the 1990s, gender became everything. It took over from feminism. Everything became about gender. We now get this extraordinary thing, gender violence. I have no idea what it means because, of course, actually it's men attacking women in the violence they're talking about. It's not violence by high-heeled shoes, as it were. So gender violence means nothing. Gender took over, and it was queer theory in particular, of course, post-structuralist theory, that allowed that to happen. So any transgressions of gender were seen as extremely revolutionary, and then there was the development of the category transgender out of that, and the trans were the persons who in any way defied the category of gender. So in there was anybody doing gender in sadomasochism, there was anybody be doing a little bit of something that the other sex would not normally be expected to wear, and so on and so on and so on. Huge numbers of persons were dragged into this category, transgender. They were all seen as transgressive and became somehow de facto revolutionaries. So that was something important that queer theory did. It was completely opposite to feminism and extraordinarily undermining thereof. And one upshot of it, for instance, could be that at my university, the women's group of the Students' Union, which is now spelled WOM apostrophe N. I'm not quite sure why that is, because the apostrophe could mean that it's a swear word, or it could mean that it's a category in constant flux. But they have on their program for the coming semester an activity which is for all those identifying as women, so there are no actual women left, and another group which is for all genders. So that's another thing that happened. There became lots and lots of genders. There was an obliteration of the feminist idea that actually gender was about dominance and submission. Masculinity was the gender of the ruling class. Femininity was the gender of the subordinate class. And actually those practices were practices of dominance and submission. So that's all gone. And we've got into all kinds of rather extraordinary nonsense. And I've become, I'm sure very many of us have become aware of how much the heads of young people, particularly young lesbians and gay men, have been very much trammeled by this nonsense in the last decade or so, all of which comes out of queer theory, the idea that not only is there no such thing as a man or a woman, this is some kind of limited essentialist category, we should all be transing to some extent, it's old-fashioned to be able to identify as being a man or a woman, and so on. So this is extraordinarily confusing for young people, because of course women are subordinated on the basis of sex. Fetuses that are aborted in the womb because they're female do not have a gender. There are no high-heeled shoes in the womb. So the subordination of women is based upon sex. But what queer theory has done, queer and postmodern theory, is construct the idea that everything is gender, and if we just transit, the revolution has happened. Unfortunately, women are left out there doing the housework, cleaning the toilets, suffering rape and violence, wearing constricting clothing and so on, and nothing has really happened because the transgression of gender does nothing at all except be a sort of prancing about activity of privileged people.
I want to find very quickly a quote by Arthur Evans, who wrote Witchcraft and the Great Gay Counterculture. And he, in the 1980s, had a debate with another gay male about BDSM, about S&M, sadomasochistic practices. And one of the things that he wrote, which I really like, he was against sadomasochism very strongly, and he wrote, we also have to reflect on the implications of what we do, both for ourselves and the society at large. We have to do so for sex and for every other aspect of our lives. That's what it means to be a mature human being. And I really, it seems to be that there is no coincidence with you talking about the sort of rise of queer theory, you know, starting in the mid-80s or, you know, moving up through the 90s with the whole neoliberal ethos. And that was about the same time that the neo-environmentalism really started to take over from the old-school environmentalism of, you know, wanting to protect. It's like there's this great line, when did environmentalism become not about protecting a piece of ground and instead become about continuing this society? And it seems to me that this is all sort of tied into the whole anti-communal neoliberal attitude that developed all through the 80s.
Yes, absolutely. And it's very clear in queer politics and queer theory that politics is seen to be about the personal expression of the individual. No individual must be interrupted in any way in terms of their personal expression. Preferably, that should be transgressive of any ordinary social rules. It's complete individualism with no sense of responsibility. I mean, it's not a movement. Queer theory and politics don't represent a movement where you are responsible to others in the movement and you actually want to change the world for everybody. Whereas, of course, back in 70s feminism and early 80s feminism, we were all talking about living the revolution now, how you actually live your life and how you relate to other people. Creates a prefigurative form, I think we used to call it in those days, that will actually create the framework for how the future society will develop. Well, there's none of that in queer theory or queer politics unless we want to understand that the world of the future will be everybody engaging in their individual sexual practice wherever they wish and in whatever ways that they wish.
I'm thinking about, you just said about it's queer theory is not about a movement. How can you have a movement when your movement is essentially what was it that the definition from Queering Anarchism? The definition was something about queer theory is against what is normal. Or I'm trying to find another quote. David Halperin. It's a pretty commonly accepted definition of queer. Queer is, by definition, whatever is at odds with the normal, the legitimate, the dominant. There is nothing in particular to which it necessarily refers. It is an identity without an essence. And I have to tell you, when I read that, once again, my brain exploded. This is like, this makes no sense to me. I can't, you know, I'm not a stupid person, but I can't I can't understand how somebody could write those sentences and then an editor could not edit them out and a publisher could publish them. It's meaningless.
Oh, indeed. A lot of the theory is extraordinarily hard to understand, as postmodern theory is in general. And I always see it as being a bit like sort of Latin in the Middle Ages. The Bible was in Latin so that ordinary people could not understand it, because I don't think it is expected to be sort of generally understood as a theory under politics.
So I guess I have two questions. We have about 5 minutes left. And one of them is, when I was writing the sections on queer theory for my book, when I would talk to friends who hadn't thought about these issues much, you know, mainly like environmental activists or you know, various you know, people who work on issues around workers, they said that they had been sympathetic to queer theory because they had this idea, because they hadn't really thought about it, they hadn't read anything, and they just had this general idea that basically, since queer is a slur, that this was basically about homosexuals attempting to reclaim pride. And so it was generally, you know, if you're there was this, what I'm trying to get at is there was this, it feels like there's been this Trojan horse thing going on that a lot of the public might think, oh, you know, I don't want to be prejudiced against homosexuals, so yeah, I must like queer theory. But then when they actually hear what queer theory is about, they're completely appalled. Is what I'm saying making any sense?
Yes, I think that's right. I think there's an automatic feeling that queer must be accepted because it represents the revolutionary politics of lesbians and gay men. I think we need to get rid of the term, get rid of the politics, go back to gay liberation and lesbian feminism and talk about political values. Because, of course, queer politics and theory is very, very much liked by male-dominated, heteropatriarchal capitalist society, if you like, because it threatens nobody. It's simply the acting out that's always gone on. There's no movement, there's no attempt to create change, there's no blueprint for change, and so on. So I think it's just very sort of privileged capering about, to be honest with you.
So I just thought of one more question I would like to ask before we wrap up, which is, if you could respond to a quote that was on an article on Huffington Post by Andrew Eckstein, and his quote is, "The same methods historically used by the government to imprison and pathologize homosexuality and gender variation are being used today to justify the extreme marginalization, lifetime institutionalization, and the oppression of people who have violated sex laws. Sex offenders are the new queers." And he's talking about pedophiles, among others.
Well, I am astonished by that quote, although I have been following on the internet in the last few days the fact that the Sylvia Rivera legal project, which is supposed to be about transgender rights, is defending the rights of men who say they are transgender and are in prison for practices of paedophilia, rape of women, and so on. None of this is totally, totally new, you know, because way back in the 70s, when deviancy theory within sociology was tremendously popular, all of those oppressed by the state were seen as somehow revolutionary. So, you know, those who had done sexual offenses and so on had to be positive. They were deviant. They were actually those who were calling attention to what was wrong with the state, and they were imprisoned and so on. There was this romanticization of men who committed terrible offenses. So I'm not surprised that it is still out there, although it is shocking that it would be.
Yeah, I was shocked too, and saddened, deeply, deeply saddened. So, okay, so having covered a lot of ground here, we have like a minute or two left, or a couple 3 minutes, and so having listened to this interview, and once they can sit with it for a couple days and really sort of absorb it, what would you hope that people would do in response to what you're saying, and what would you want people to do?
I want, well, what's already happening, in fact, is that there are very many much younger feminists out there on the internet right now and gathering together as well, who are rejecting queer politics and queer theory, who don't like it when they come across it at universities. What we need to be doing is building a political project for lesbians and gay men again. That means that we actually have to get rid of the romanticizing of gender and recognize that we have to get rid of gender. Gender has to be abolished. We have to create the possibility of humans being human and not having to be in roles of any kind, whether they're swapping them or whatever else they're doing. We need a lesbian and gay politics which is truly political, which has a structural analysis, which is related to other projects of liberation, rather than simply some kind of privileged flim-flam. So we really need to get rid of the queer politics, which is leading to very, very many very serious problems presently of young lesbians rejecting their lesbianism and thinking they must be trans and that somehow they must be men, young people having no sense of who they really are, just thinking they should have an identity and therefore the body means nothing, and so on. So to get rid of some of the very serious problems that are troubling and badly affecting the lives of young lesbians and gay men, we really need to create a political lesbian and gay movement again, which has structural analysis and politics.
So I guess I said that was going to be the end, but I have one more comment. Sorry about this. But speaking of gender roles, somebody wrote to me a while back and said that there was a little boy who likes to sing and dance, and he's like 3 or 4, and this was evidence that this little boy is actually a little girl. And I responded, why does it have to, if he likes to sing and dance, why does that mean he's a little girl? Why can't a little boy like to sing and dance? Isn't that kind of the point, is that boys should be able to sing and boys should be able to dance and boys should be able to, and girls should be able to, that isn't that kind of the point of abolishing gender, is that we can simply be who we are?
Absolutely. And queer politics is about hanging on to gender because it's sexually exciting to do forms of dominance and submission. They defend gender utterly to the point at which they defend the transing of children, which is the most conservative and vicious practice that a patriarchal state can possibly imagine, to actually carve sex roles and stereotypes onto the bodies of children and young people is extraordinarily oppressive. But that is where, in the end, queer politics and its extraordinary defense of gender has got us.
So thank you so much for being on the program, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Sheila Jeffries. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.